Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to listen to. Quite a bit of news from recently, but I'm not sure how much I need to share here, but it's been a while, maybe, what, 5 or 6 days since I finished this book. I definitely finished it on Monday, and I know I finished it on Monday, because on Monday I was in quarantine in my cabin on the cruise ship that I was working on with some GI sickness and spent a good few hours vomiting and then I had to be, you know, just sit around in my room. I didn't have any energy at all. And so that's when I finished off this book, when I had no energy to do anything else, not even watch TV. Well, that was too much for me, but I did finish off this book. Surface Detail is the book I'm getting to. But then on Tuesday, I had a full day with work. I had to perform 2 shows in the evening. Now, after being in quarantine, for vomiting guts up, having to do 2 1-hour shows, or one show was 50 minutes and the other show was 1 hour the next night, I didn't have any energy, and there were some of the strangest shows I've ever done. And then on Wednesday I had to travel home from the end of my gig, and I missed breakfast in the morning and then a long day traveling. I got home at 8:29, and at 8:30 I had a meeting of creative people coming around to my house for some creative group that I'm involved in, and there was like 15 other people in the house, and that was really stressful. And then I was meant to take part that evening in a podcast recording for another podcast, the Friday Night Party Line podcast, and I got about 5 minutes into it and then I was like, hey guys, I'm just gonna have to stop this, and just completely bailed in it because too much ill. And then on Thursday I hung out, and I got a new girlfriend now, so I was hanging out with my girlfriend, so and she was in hospital as well because for suspected was it appendicitis and things like that, and different things wrong with her. And then Friday, I can't remember what I did on Friday. It was, oh yeah, I had a guest around. Oh no, that's what I did on Friday. Yeah, I managed to slash my finger open really, really badly. This massive cut on my finger when I was washing up a glass in my hand broke, and I slashed the back of the knuckle of my forefinger on my right hand so much that blood literally sprayed across the kitchen and across my t-shirt and things like that. And there was a lot of blood, so I had to patch that up. Yesterday, I took part in the Berlin Photo Marathon, where you have to travel around Berlin and take 24 photos in 12 hours and do all that kind of stuff, and I completely failed at that. You can check out my blog for the full story of that too, but it turns out that my body just wasn't up for it. So today I've had a completely random day after one of the most stressful weeks of my life, well, not of my life, one of the most stressful weeks of the last few years. And it's been a really good week, but just I had this illness on Monday and just never let my body recover at all. But now I've had a good relaxing day today, and I'll have another relaxing day tomorrow and on Tuesday. I have no plans to do anything that important or that strenuous. But I thought I'll just get this review done now. I haven't made that many notes for this book, but because it's, well, the thing is, it's a really big book. There's a lot going on in it, and so I thought what I'd do is, you know, sort of just explore the themes of the book as I go along, trying to save them all up to the end, because different aspects of the book, I'm sure, will have comments on different thematic explorations and ideas that Ian M. Banks always goes for throughout the book. So hopefully I'll get them through, but I will go through the normal format of the review here. So yeah, Surface Detail, published last year by Ian M. Banks, October 2000, and it says here on the goodreads.com page. And I listened to it as an audiobook, and it lasted about 21 hours, so it's actually quite a big chunky book, I guess, probably around about 600 pages or something like that. And the reason I read it was because, well, it's an Ian M. Banks book, and I generally try and keep up with his science fiction output. Although the last few books that he's put out, his last few science fiction books, there was it Transmission, Matter, and The Algebrist. None of them were bad books, but they just weren't very good compared to the normal level of writing and storytelling that I expect from Ian M. Banks. So this was not a sort of, hey, rush out and buy it as soon as it comes out kind of book. But it was recommended to me as an audiobook by quite a few listeners, and my brother said, hey, check it out, it's got one of the best readings I've ever heard. So I kept waiting for it to come out as an audiobook here in Germany, but it never did. It was never licensed. So in the end, I illegally downloaded this, and I'm happy to say that I illegally downloaded it. It's one of those things that I have money, I want to pay money. It's actually illegal. It's against it. the only way that I can download this audiobook living within Germany is to do it illegally. Nobody will take my money to let me listen to this book legally. Such is the publishing industry and audiobook rights that get sold around the world. I guess if I wanted to download a German version of this book, I probably could in Germany, but not the English version of this book. So the quicker that Audible and all these other companies and countries and license agreements, all these get sorted out, the better. Like Alistair Reynolds, he got given he got some million pounds or something book deal, but what he didn't get to do was he didn't get to decide or keep his own international rights. All his international rights were bought from him by the publisher. So that means all of his books come out in Audible, audio versions straight away, all the way around the world, because the audio, it's all done through one publisher. His worldwide rights are done through one publisher rather than him contracting in each different territory with different publishers for different rights, for the electronic rights here, the normal paper book rights, the paperback rights here, the hardcover rights go to this company, the audio rights go to... Anyway, so fuck it, that's a little rant from me here. Yeah, what was I up to? So yes, let's get straight into this. So the setting of this book, it's a culture novel, and I'm not going to go too much into the Ian M. Banks culture setting, but it is a world that he talks about and sets a lot of his books in. I think this is sort of maybe like the 8th or 9th or 10th book that he has written about in this universe. And the culture is a what they call a pan-human, or what is it, sort of human style, lots of human style civilizations, or human-shaped bodied people get together, and they created the ship's minds, and these minds are sort of these artificial intelligences which run things for the humans. So you get billions upon, well, probably trillions and trillions of humans spread throughout the galaxy, and they all ride on different ships and different orbitals and different things like that. And there's different levels of the culture. Generally, people just hang out in the culture and they do what they want. And then there's the a part of culture called contact. And contact is people who volunteer to have contact between the culture and other civilizations, other alien races, other, you know, emerging civilizations, other sort of like all the different technology levels and things like that. And we find out that there's not just culture, there's other sort of different within culture, there's different sections which deal with different kinds of outside culture specialities. There's the special circumstances, which deals with sort of that sort of like the spy group, and they go in and influence politics in other civilizations to try and make them more culture-like, and sort of they deal with war, and they deal with like these weird once-in-a-lifetime outside... What's the accession? I can't remember what the phrases that they use in accession, but sort of like the outside, the normal... normal way of things. That's what special circumstance deals with. And there's these other factions. Some of them deal with the minds of the sublimed races, the people who have already gone on towards godhood, and others sort of like with this and this, and also with the different people who deal with like the electronic afterlives, and there's different situations within special circumstances and culture. And a lot of it's all run by the ship minds, but of course we often follow the human stories within this as well. So that's we sort of like this background. Read the culture books if you need to. A good one to start with is, of course, Player of Games or Consider Phlebas. Those are the ones that most people read first to get into the culture world. This book, not good for that at all. Don't start with this book. Because what's happened more recently is that within the culture books, there's not actually all that much to say about life within the culture. If you want to find, you know, if you want to read that kind of book, Look to Windward is a good book, because it talks about, you know, what life is like being a citizen of the culture, and that's pretty good. And you get someone who isn't part of the culture coming in and living on the culture orbital for a while and sort of getting a flavor of the life. That's pretty cool. But what we have really is the things on the like on the edges of the culture is where the stories really take place. It's where contact and special circumstances rubs up against other civilizations and other star-faring civilizations outside of the culture. So it's everything... The only real drama that can take place is on the periphery of the culture, because the culture itself isn't exciting anymore. It's too powerful. And I guess the other place where stories can take place is in virtual environments, but I'll get onto that a bit more in a bit. So what we have here in this book is, in surface detail, the book starts off with Ledeja, and she's a woman on the run, and we don't know why she's on the run, but then we find out she's some kind of slave, and she's in an opera house, and she's running away from a guy called Veppers, who's her sort of her owner, but we're not quite sure what's going on here. And at one point she's hiding in the scenery that's being flown above the stage of the opera house, and she's hiding on something, this painted scenery, and she goes, oh, this is ironic that I'm hiding on something painted. And I'm thinking, well, why is it ironic? And it turns out, we find out, that she's more than owned as a slave. She's sort of like completely owned, because, and this is a really interesting take on slavery, which I've not really quite seen before. I've seen similar things before, but it sort of, it goes, what holds you, sort of the idea is being, what holds you under the ownership of someone else? And it could be something written on a paper, like, this person belongs to this person, but if that piece of paper is destroyed, you can say, well, they're no longer a slave. Or maybe it's sort of just a receipt. Well, that's a bit of paper as well. So maybe it's like a mark on the skin, like you get it, so you're a slave and you get something tattooed on your skin, and then that says, okay, that person's a slave. But if you then get that tattoo removed, would you still be a slave? Is the tattoo the mark of slavery, or is the person the actual slave itself? You know, and there's these different things in the Bible. It says if after 7 years you still want to be someone's slave, you pierce their ear. So maybe, okay, so if you let your piercing on your ear close up, or if you chop your ear off, would you still be a slave? It's a very strange thing. So what Ledeja has is that before she was born, she was genetically modified so that she has markings over all of her skin. She's got this black skin with these silver markings all over her body. But then each individual, like it's not just on her skin, but it's also on the layers of fat under her skin, and on her veins are the markings. And if you go all the way down to like the cellular level, so just the pattern of her veins around her body are set out in geometric patterns, and the structure of her bones isn't just sort of like, you know, the random honeycomb style, not honeycomb, what am I trying to say? But, you know, just like the cellular way, just the way that cells are arranged in the body are in different, geometric patterns, and there's geometric patterns on the cells themselves. So down to like a cellular level, on a fractal level, all the way down, Ledeja is owned. And this is what's called, intagliature in this book. She's an intagliate, and things like that. So the whole idea is, like, at the very beginning of the book, we don't really find out in the first chapter, but this is what you find out a bit later on. It's like, well, how can she escape? Of course, she can't escape, because no matter where she goes, and no matter what traces she leaves behind, there's no way to show that she is not a slave. I mean, there's no way to show that she's not a slave. Every single part of about her says, I am owned by someone. So she can't escape, of course. And at the end of the first chapter, she is killed by her owner, Joy LeVeppers. And I'm just like, oh, well, that sort of caught me out. Now, Ian M. Banks is well known for killing his main characters in his books. I'm not going to lie to you there. Quite a lot of his main characters don't make it through to the end, or they die at the very end. But so I trusted him with this. I was like, okay, main character died. Unlike Stephen Erickson, who, you know, I was reading The Gardens of the Moon, where he killed someone in the first 100 pages, and then it felt like a trick, and he brought him back to life again. I was like, oh, that's a bit silly. Someone sent me an email saying, oh, Gardens of the Moon is based on a role-playing session that Stephen Erickson had with his friends. And then I was like, oh, okay, so this guy lost his battle, but then he threw the dice and was sent back by the gods or something to carry on. I was like, oh, that makes sense. But anyway, Ian M. Banks, he's earned the right to play tricks on me. So I thought, well, I'll leave it. More on that in a second. Another character that we meet, actually the next character in the next chapter, is a guy called Vatuel, and he is a miner in a siege, and he was once an officer but was sent down the mines because he was insubordinate. And I wasn't quite sure what the setting was, because it's like in this medieval setting where they're trying to capture a castle with mining underneath the castle walls. And so I was thinking, well, is it on a non-cultured planet or in a different civilization? Or like in the book Matter, there's this weird medieval, not medieval, it's more sort of, 19th century almost, society set inside of a hollow container with lots of different things in it. And, it, you know, so it's an alien civilization, like, in the real world. I was thinking maybe it's a culture orbital, and it's some kind of fantasy game that people are playing, and everyone's playing a role, and they're all backed up. And we don't find out right away, but then the chapter ends with Vatuel dying again. He just dies, and I'm like, oh, so two chapters in a row that the main character dies at the end of it. So I was thinking, is this book going to be about death? And then in the next chapter, or the next one, I worked out that the book is not about death. Not really. Well, it is kind of, but it's really about the afterlife. And that's what this book is all about. It's the afterlife and the purpose of it and the reasons for it and how much it influences you in the real world, how you're going to, what's going to happen to you after you die. Now, this is news to me because I started reading this without reading the blurb on the back of the book or without reading any reviews. Generally, I don't like reading reviews before I read the book. I like reading recommendations, so people say, hey, you'll like this book because of this. I'm like, great. But actually the reviews itself is what I, you know, which outline the story and the characters. I don't have any interest in reading them before I read a book. So what happens is Ledeja, let me put it this way. So it's about death and the afterlife. So Ledeja, she is reincarnated using culture technology, re-sleeved or reanimated or whatever you want to call it there as well. This is what you can do within the culture, no problem at all. If you die, you're backed up all the time and you can reanimate your body. And she gets a new body in the real world. She didn't know that she could, because she's not someone in the culture, but we work out why she is reincarnated within the culture. And she decides to head back to her home planet as she has unfinished business with Veppers, her old owner, because he killed her in cold blood. And of course, there's unfinished business there. And it's a really interesting, like I say, exploration of reincarnation and what we take with us from one life to the next. And, you know, she takes her mind and her soul and her personality, but not her body. And her body used to have slave markings, but of course her new body doesn't have slave markings. And she has to deal with all of that and things because now she is suddenly free in this new life. And actually, to be honest, in this book, I was never really convinced that all she wanted to do was get revenge on Veppers, because I thought that was a little bit too simplistic of Ian M. Banks. And my suspicions were borne out with the last characters. I'm not being clever about this, but, you know, if you've read enough of Banks's book, Ian M. Banks' books, you know that a lot of the main characters keep secrets from the readers, even though they're told it's sort of, it's like this third person, you know, sort of like quite close third person narrative, that we're often inside their minds and we're knowing what they're thinking. But even when they retell their backstories, they'll leave out these massive details and then they'll spring them in the last chapter, which then causes the rest of the story to be sort of cast in a different light. But I know that's coming. So I often, like, if once I work out what the main character is, there's these little signs that you'll pick up and I'm like, oh, I know what's going on here. So that's sort of like, and it, also there's another twist that's revealed in like the epilogue section at the end, that some characters keep secrets from themselves in the story too. And we've seen this a lot of times in these culture novels, because what someone can do, they can make a decision and then they can decide to wipe the memory of them making that choice from their minds so they can do a better job. So they don't know that they've made the decision. It's only when they've actually fulfilled their role, that they find out that they, have actually done the job that they were meant to do before they wiped their mind that made the decision to do what they wanted to do. It's complicated, but you expect to see that. I sometimes expect to see that in these culture novels, and then it goes. So other characters that we follow, we find themselves in hell, and this is real hell. I mean, it's a virtual hell, but it's actually real that you can't avoid it. This is the first time it's been talked about in these culture novels, but mainly because the culture, their afterlife is either heaven or obliteration, or generally what most people do. But we find out this actually quite a bit in the culture novel called Accession. We find out that a lot of people, they grow old and they're like, well, I don't want to die completely, so I'll just back up my mind and my body and I'll just put it into storage and then say, if anything interesting happens, you can get me out of storage, or if you need to speak to me, get me out of storage and stuff like that. So that's what a lot of people do. So they never die, they just put off death as long as possible, just back up their mind in different places. And also in the book Look to Windward, we discover that some people commit suicide and actually make sure all of their backups are wiped and then wipe their own minds or kill their own minds and things like that, which is interesting. But there's no such thing as hell. They don't need hell. Why should there be hell? But other different non-culture civilizations have forms of hell. They actually put these different mind state recorders into all of their citizenry. guess that's how it works, or maybe just it's bred into them that this that they can actually, when someone dies, their mind is taken, and they're either sent to heaven if they've been good, or they are sent to hell if they've been bad. But of course, who decides if you've been bad or not? Why do you need to be bad or not? And then they live through eternal punishment, and these punishments are real. And this is one of the main conflicts of the book, between the different civilizations which want hell to exist and they think hell is necessary, and between the people who don't think hell exists. Now, there's these two, we actually see the insides of hell with these two characters. These are non-human, non-pan-human characters called Prin and Shay, and they're in hell by choice, because they live in a civilization where hell exists, but everyone says, oh, but it's not really, hell doesn't really exist, but we just have to keep people believing that hell exists to keep civilization in line. But, and they say, but no, hell really does exist. And they manage to hack their way into hell using sort of computer, and they go through hell for a bit and then try and get out of hell again. And then they'll tell their story in, you know, to people later on. So that's an interesting bit that we actually get an experience of hell, and not just one hell, because some of these characters keep going back to hell or to different kind of hells, and we find out what actually makes hell, and that is the hope of redemption completely, utterly removed. It's not just the pain, it's not just the constant burning, it's not just the constant acid in your blood and all of the nasty things that happen to you. One of the most important things is, of course, the lack of hope in hell. And let's bring it back to Vatuil, who dies in one war. I just mentioned that, and he was just a minor. And he returns to another war. And then when he dies there, he returns to another war, another conflict, another place in a different realm. So what we have here is something called a confliction, and a confliction is a politically binding virtual game, virtual reality war, which beforehand both sides say, hey, we want to, you know, work out who comes out ahead or anything like that, but we don't want to actually have a war in the real world, we'll have a virtual war. And so it's a little bit like what we have in the Player of Games, where there's a civilization where everyone plays this one game, and if you want to get into government, you have to play the game best, and the better you play the game, the better you do politically. And of course, what happens is the culture sends someone in to play this game to the idea is to non-violently or non-threateningly change that civilization from the inside via a game. So we have something similar here, and so the confliction takes place, like I say, in this. It's overseen by this civilization, this alien civilization, which is totally fair and to the point of being really, really boring. They can't be corrupted, can't be anything. So they're running the servers, and everyone who's on the servers is either on one side of the war, the pro-hell side or the anti-hell side. And we follow Vatuil and... so he's on one of the sides in the war, and the idea being that when he dies, nobody really dies in this war, but they return to it, and how well, like in the Player of Games, how well they've done in one game decides how much power they're going to have in the next game. And Vatuil, he keeps fighting in a war and then comes back again to a different theater of war and then keeps going back, and because he keeps doing really well, sometimes he's fighting a sea battle, and sometimes he's fighting a space battle, and sometimes he's fighting different battles in ways that in arenas that you can't even, you know, there's no analog in our human experience so far to the kind of wars that he's fighting. And he keeps doing well. And even when he fails in an honorable way, in a clever way, and in an inventive way. And he keeps moving his way up the chain of command. And this, of course, reminded me of very much of Use of Weapons, as Sakalwi was. He fulfills a similar function there. He keeps working his way through different theaters of war. And each time we go back to, you know, his chapters, he's working his way up through the command. Actually, his chapters are told in the reverse order. So he's working his way down through the command of different things. At one point, he's fighting on a civilization level, another time on a country level, another time a tribal level, another times, you know, and that's the same thing that happens in this book as well. And again, that's not just me being clever, but, you know, minor spoiler. Check out the end of this book. You'll see some that this is not a coincidence that I've made that connection. But in this case, the culture is anti-hell, so it isn't involved in, but it isn't involved in the war because it wants to stay clear because it's too powerful. And what they need to do is for a confliction to be politically binding afterwards. Everyone has to agree at the beginning that there's no catch. There's nobody going, oh, well, of course you're always going to win because you always had the culture on your side. So it's not even fair as starting because of course you're going to win. So they need to sort of make it slight, kind of equally balanced at the beginning so the culture wasn't throwing its weight into this war. But so they're staying clear. So that's the stages set really for this. The two, I'd say one of the two main parts of the story is Ledeja's revenge and her going back to Joy LaVepa's, back on the civilization, the non-culture civilization where Joy LaVepa's is. And of course that is in various different ways tied into the culture trying to and failing to stay out of the war in heaven, as it's called. The confliction is called the war in heaven. So the culture's trying to stay out of it, but of course, it doesn't. they special circumstances isn't very clever at staying out of business which isn't theirs. Let me put it that way. There's lots of other lead characters involved in this book, and some of them are almost more important to the story that I've told than these characters that I talked about here. But these two characters, I think. So represent the main views or two of the main views on the afterlife. One is Ledeja and Vatuel, they're the reincarnation side of the view of the afterlife, and Prin and Shay are the oh shit we're going to hell kind of side of the afterlife. And heaven doesn't really get a view looking on this book, but again, nobody's got any problem with people going to heaven, because what is heaven? If it's a virtual heaven, all it is a very nice long-term I decide what's good for me and make it so kind of virtual reality simulation that you could go into. So that wouldn't, in a way, that wouldn't even be called death. That's just sort of like deciding to go into a different kind of reality. So that's the main plot, I guess, or some of the things. For one, I think this plot is too long. There's this big bit about two-thirds of the way through that really kind of drags up. You know, up until that point, everything was setting the stage and going forward and people were moving around. And then it's suddenly we go, oh, okay, and now let's have a chapter of backstory here. Oh, and now here's another character we're introducing and we have to get to know this character. They're not going to impact the plot at all. You can see they're not going to impact the plot at all, because if they did, they would have been introduced earlier on in the book. But it seems to just, we just need someone, something important's going to happen and none of our main characters are going to be there, so let me just introduce this new character so we can have someone on the scene for this important conflict that takes place here. And then we get these long descriptions of technology, and it's really cool technology, but like if you've read the culture book Accession, you know all about how a skin suit works, and you see them in action there, and in lots of details. Like in Accession, someone burps, and the skin suit is like a very, very flexible outer garment that you wear. Well, it's sort of an inner garment in a way that you wear under your clothes, and it stretches around your skin, but it keeps you safe in vacuum and things like that. And there's it even covers over your eyes and it covers over your mouth, so when you're breathing, it provides you air and things like that. And this one guy sneezes or burps or something, I can't remember what it is, but and then a bubble grows up around his nose and his mouth, and then the suit goes, okay, let's get rid of this bubble, but there's always a bubble over the mouth and nose. And so we find out about all that suit and we see in action. And then in this novel, in Surface Detail, we get this long description of someone putting on one of these suits for the first time and this other different kind of stuff, and then they don't even use it, and later they just take it off. So I'm like, why did we spend all that time? If we're going to have cool technology like this, let's at least see it in action. But we don't even see it in action. They just put it on and then take it off again, which is a bit strange. And then the very end of the novel is a little bit slapdash. It seems to be, I mean, not, and it's certainly not as bad as unsatisfying as the end of Matter, where they just go, oh, and then a spaceship comes in and that's it. But we have like the way that Ledeja's conflict with Vepa's is sort of sorted out is a little bit obvious. You know, the setting where the final, you know, showdown between the two of them takes place, really, really obvious due to it being mentioned over and over and over again. It's a place of significance for both characters, and they just both happen to end up there when they have the showdown at the end. And then even the choice of weapon is like super obvious all the way through. Maybe just to me, but it seemed a little bit too obvious in that way. But other strands of the story were tied up, actually, I was going to say, a little bit less subtly. No, I actually think most of the end of this story was a bit obvious, like the way that the Hell story was wrapped up, a little bit obvious as well. and a little bit tidily. I think that, like, for example, like at the end of this, there's been this confliction, and one side sort of, I wouldn't say one side wins and one side loses, but it comes to the end, and I'd thought the way that it ended would be, you know, there'd be some real fallout from that, because it seems to be in this book that everyone keeps talking, all the ship's minds keep talking about the Idrian War, which took place 1,500 years ago in the culture past. You can read about that in Considered Phlebas. And so it's a bit, you know, where, like, this massive external threat, and, you know, they were, the culture was losing the war, and then they all rallied around and fought back and won the war, a bit like World War II in a way. And in the same way that World War II there happens, that it's still in living memory and that people went through that, and, you know, that you can still see the marks of it on the landscape. You know, living in Berlin, you can see it all over the place, that massive conflict. So it's there in the back, and all the ships have post-traumatic stress disorder, and they're all weird, and they all go, oh, I can't deal with life anymore, I'm getting out of here, I'm going to become a registered eccentric and get out. And so we know that wars can have, like, real fallouts, for long-term fallouts, but this one, they just seem to go, oh yeah, and then there was the end of the war, and then the epilogue, it just sort of fades away, and I'm thinking, wow, that was a bit not so conclusive. And then there's other things in the book, like there's the big old alien race called the Bublicans, can't remember what the name was now, and we spent a lot of time with them, and I thought, oh, this is really interesting, and then they seem to be a bit of a red herring. I don't mind red herrings, but it felt like, you know, these different threads of the novel that we went to about two-thirds of the way through really slowed it down and kept me guessing in some ways, but not kept me guessing in other ways. But it is a solid plot. It is solid. But sometimes, I'll get onto that later. Maybe I'll talk about that later on. So coming up to the characters. Now, of course, the ship's minds are always steal the show. One of the main characters here is a ship called Falling Outside the Normal Moral Constraints, because this is something that we get with all different culture ships. They take their own names, and they take very their names lack gravitas, let me put it that way, compared to normal ship naming conventions, and, you know, ironic names. So this is like the Fast Picket, or what is it, the Fast Offensive Ship Falling Outside the Normal Moral Constraints. And there's other ones. I can't remember the different names of the ship here, but I'm sure there'll be a let me check Wikipedia here. So if I culture, oh yeah, so there's like culture minds have their own names. One's called anticipation of a new lover's arrival, or just testing. You know, there's lots of these different ships minds, and they're pretty cool. One second.
Hey Elder, what's up? I'm just recording something, so don't disturb me, please.
Where was I up to? Oh, I've got distracted now. So yeah, and so they always, like I say, really interesting characters. They're doing lots of different stuff. And then the human characters, again, it's a bit strange because you don't really, you know, I'm never really interested in human characters who are brought up within the culture, because the human characters within the culture have been, they've been coddled throughout their lives, and it's only the people who really break through into, like, the special circumstances units who have any real drive. And other civilizations within the setting of this book, within the universe of this book, always look at the culture and go, oh, well, all your citizens are a bit wet, a bit wimpy, they don't do very much, and things like that. It's your ship's minds which run the show and do everything. And that actually seems to bear through within the writing itself. I actually want a little bit more interesting human characters, but I guess they just can't come from within the culture. And that's why so many of these books are written from outside of the culture's point of view, which is why I really enjoyed reading about Prin and Shay, who are these non-pan-human aliens, and they've got four legs and two trunks, like they're a bit sort of like elephantine kind of things. And they have this strength and resolve that you don't really see so much portrayed so much within the characters from or the characters from within the culture themselves. So, yeah, and that's why, like I say, that's why these books have to focus on these different people, which is unfortunate because they often get lumped in or get tied it in with the culture ships. And then the ships are always so powerful in these compared to the technology of the non-culture civilizations, that often the culture ships becomes the deus ex machinas, which just come in and solve the problems at the end. They go bish, bash, bosh, and then everything's gone like that. But we don't get that with Prin and Shay's story. They actually have to fight within their own civilization for what they want. And it's very interesting to see very strong characters actually fight for what they believe in, but not in a, hey, I've got a ship with me and a drone and all of this kind of stuff, and I'm going to go in there and kick ass. I actually have to be principled. I'm going to do political maneuvering in a situation where everything isn't just run by the ship's mind. So that's very, that's good too. And then there's the normal pairing, or a common pairing that we get within Ian M. Banks' culture novels, is the strong female character and a drone. And a drone is like this floating suitcase-sized robot that goes around with them and helps protect them and advises them in what they want to do. And generally, the drone could do everything, but because in special circumstances and contact, they often have to work with non-culture civilizations. Non-culture civilizations never want to talk to ships' minds or robots or anything like that. Really, they want to talk to human beings. So the human beings are almost along there just as translated between the ship's minds will and the drone's minds will, translated between them and the other civilization. But it always makes for a very interesting conversation, because the ship's mind is always like the quirky character who has all the quips, and then the strong female character has some problem in her past and she's trying to get over it, and it goes well. But in this book, it gets subverted quite nicely. Normally I talk about technology around about now. So we hear about, in culture, there's no such thing as punishment for crime. You just don't need to do crime because it's a post-scarcity environment or in civilization, so technology environment. So if you ever want anything, like if you even want to own your own planet, they can just go, oh, there's loads of planets. I'm sure we'll be able to find you a planet if you want your own planet. But why would a human want their entire own planet? What are they going to do with it? Because there's no way for them just to have their own planet with slaves on there, because we don't have slavery and things. But there's lots of different things, like why would you want to be a criminal? And there's sort of like the whole idea of crime and theft no longer exists when property is non-scarce in that way. But there's this whole thing, it's like, well, what happens if you kill someone? And we're always told that in the culture, what you do if you kill someone, or someone thinks you might kill someone, you just get given a slap drone. And a slap drone is just a drone which just follows you around and knows what you're doing. And anytime you're going to kill someone, it just stops you. And that's it. So the slap drone just follows you around and stops you doing anything bad if someone thinks that you're going to do something bad. And of course, what we have here is in Ledeja's story, we have... she goes, I have unfinished business with Joy Levepers. And they're going, do you want to kill him? Is this revenge? And she's going, I just have unfinished business. And they're like, okay, well, don't tell us this, otherwise we'll have to give you a slap drone. So she's given a slap drone. And now this would be interesting to see it work, but mild spoiler here, it doesn't work, because another one of the ship's minds treats Ledeja as just a pet that doesn't need to be worried about. And she just goes, okay, well, let's just not worry about that anymore. And we'll just get rid of the slap drone, because the mind is obviously a lot more powerful than the slap drone. And it seems a bit strange that this one device that we've heard about and read about in these other culture novels, that the slap drone is the way to stop people being murderers, that it's so trivially countered by one of the ship's minds if the ship minds want something different. So it's very much sort of like, okay, there's one law for the ship's minds and one law for the human people. And just the idea of the slap drone and how easily subverted the idea of a slap drone is by the ship's minds really shows how much the humans are just pets to the ship's minds and nothing more. They actually don't care if someone's going to be a murderer or not, because it can't affect them in any way. It's impossible for any humans within the culture to affect any non-human entity within the culture at all. That's a weird thematic thing, which is why the culture is less and less interesting, of course, even to Ian and Banks as he's writing about it. And of course, there's loads of other technology within this in here as well, and new stuff that we've not read in other culture novels. But I'll leave that for you to find out. So the writing is obviously very, very good, because Ian M. Banks, he can turn a good phrase. It's very, very funny at points and very poignant at other points as well. And it's not just the ship's names that are funny. The ships themselves are very funny. And it's actually funny writing in like the way that he writes about different, you know, so the way that he deals just with like the different viewpoints of the different characters and what parts of the story are introduced with the different viewpoint characters is very, very clever. At one point, he's the viewpoint character is, well, it's, oh, I forgot his name now, Vatuel, and he takes... within one of the war zones that he's fighting in, he gets put into a drone, but only part of his personality goes across there. So he's got this reduced mental faculties, and it sort of is then suddenly written like a children's book, because the exposition between between his little bits, so he tells a little bit of a story, and then we get a bit of backstory, and then a bit more of a story, and then more expository dialogue and things like that. But it's told in this very clever style by switching between the two of them, and also it's written in a very funny way, and it reminds me more and more of sort of like The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy with Douglas Adams. Of course, Ian M. Banks's culture novels have always been, you know, influenced by there with the clever, quirky ship's minds and the different, you know, robot characters and stuff like that, but this book seems to bring that to the fore even more. And of course, the narration is a huge part of my enjoyment of this book. I'm really glad that I waited for the audiobook. It's narrated by Peter Kenny. I don't think I've listened to a book narrated by him before, but he's very good. And he's good, but like, let me just say this. The last book that I listened to, I think, was by Jonathan Davis, who he imbues everything with import and gravitas and emotion. And Peter Kenny is the exact opposite. Almost everything he says is a joke, and he sort of revels in performing like stupid and silly over-the-top voices, which is exactly what this novel calls for. All the different culture ships, they've all got their own different voices, and it really stands out because it brings to life their personalities. And the different aliens, there's this one aliens which always talk like this, and they think very highly of themselves, but they always talk in such a high voice, and we're going, and one of them gets angry, and as he gets angry, his voice becomes more like this. And it's just like you say, Peter Kenny, he can do these voices, and I don't know how he switches between the different voices so quickly. I guess if he's a professional narrator, professional actor, that's what he gets paid to do, so he's very good at it. But yeah, it does make this book a joy to read. So coming on, I might as well just finish off now. I talked a little bit about the different themes in the book with the afterlife and death and things like that. But one thing that really does come out of this book is the overall idea of, like they say, the human's place in the culture. I just mentioned this before, how they the ships aren't just the leaders. They're not just in charge, but humans are nothing more than pets. Every role that the humans perform within the culture could also be done by a ship's mind better. And even if they need someone who looks like a human, well, the ship's minds, we find out that they have these avatars. Well, we knew they had avatars already, but the avatars are becoming more and more human-like for the situations that they need to be human for, to the point that one of the ship's minds says, hey, I'm going to have a competition. A human can take the place of my avatar, and I will control them as my avatar in my dealings with other humans. And someone takes on that role. And so it's not as if humans are just pets. They're now puppets, literally puppets. There's a character who's just a puppet, and he's happy to be that. That's what the level humans have got to as well. And in the epilogue, we find out someone gains power, and then it says, oh, but just like every single human position of, you know, authority, it was ceremonial at best, or tokenistic, or anything like that. They didn't actually have any real power. And all the way through this book, we find out that there is no reason for humans to exist within the culture because the ship's minds are taken over, which is great. I mean, it's really interesting how far Ian and Banks has taken this thought experiment. And so the culture is, you know, often held up by people as sort of like this utopian place, but like most utopian or portrayals of utopian societies are actually dystopian in the same way, that it doesn't matter how you do it, it turns out to be not a good place. And that's what the culture is becoming more and more of, that they say, oh, there's no such thing as money, you don't need to buy anything with money or anything like that. But then we have a conversation in this book where they say, ah, there's no such thing as money, but there's like the public opinion polls, but not, it's public opinion, there's no way to measure that. But then the ships, if one ship wants to do something, they have this sort of like kudos account that is, you know, almost matched between the ship's minds, because the ship's minds can keep track very easily of the standings of all the other ships in the culture and where people lie within that, and higher up the hierarchy they go. But humans, it's impossible for humans to even take part in that. So in a way, there is a currency of public opinion within the ship's minds. So it's like a virtual currency of esteem among the different ships that they can deal with. But the humans, there's no way for them into it. So there is actually an economy. There is commerce. There is trade and things like that between the ships using favors and things like that. But how does a human do that? The only way that humans can get in and even earn any of these favors or kudos or esteem or anything is by taking part in these different contact units, the ones that deal with the afterlife, of course, the special circumstances. I can't remember the names of them because it's been 5 or 6 days since I finished this book, but they're all there. So it's getting to the point, like you say, where humans are no longer even in the picture. In the book Accession, that was really just a book about ships' minds, and the human roles in there were just sort of like, oh, we need you to get in contact with this person for us, as a human to human, you can do that, or pan-human to pan-human, you can deal with that kind of stuff. So what I really want is for Ian M. Banks to destroy the culture, or to really explicitly bring this idea into one of his books in the future. This is a very good, like you say, he's explored all these different themes of like the afterlife, of suicide, and of death and the war. He's post-traumatic stress disorder. He's explored all these themes, but I really want him to now explore the theme, his world that he's created. He can now explore the themes that come up not within our human world here in the 21st century on Earth, our themes. He can explore the themes that would come up within the culture. And I think this is good, because I've actually read some other bloggers and other reviewers saying the same thing about Ian M. Banks. He said the culture needs to be tested, but not just tested in a way that the ship's minds can do, can deal with it. Like in Accession, something comes in, it's like all the ship's minds get together and work out what needs to be done and deal with it. Or in this time, or in this book, where something comes up and, it's left to the non-culture people outside of the culture to deal with it. What I want is a conflict within the culture, which will destroy the culture as we know it. And my idea, or one idea that I had, it was like, we need the ships to turn on each other over the role of the humans within the culture. I really want sort of like a whole faction of ships to say, okay, we're going to get rid of, they all suddenly come to the conclusion at the same time. Maybe like 70% of the ship's mind say, okay, we're sick of dealing with humans anymore. We want to go off and do our own thing. And we think all ships' minds should join us and get rid of the humans, or put them down onto planets where they can deal with themselves, and they're being expelled from the culture, because really what the culture is now is just ships' minds with humans as pets. And then maybe another set of ships' minds, like the minority of ships' minds, saying, no, what we want to do is we want to bring the humans back to our level. So we should dumb ourselves down a little bit as ships, or actually admit that they, or let me put it this way. The culture was based on the idea that ships' minds and the drones' minds and everything were equal to humans, and they want to bring the level of their ships' minds a bit further back down, and the power and the authority of the ships' minds back down into line with the humans. Maybe not down to human level, but more in line with the humans, so the humans can actually be involved in the running of the culture and being more involved in the culture of the culture a bit more. And it would be really interesting to see these two diametrically opposed situations, and it almost leads to war. But then, how about they have a confliction like we have in this book? So instead of having the ships fight out, in the real world, it happens in virtual reality, which we know can happen and it might work. But then how about the ship's minds? They're not allowed to be involved in this. So we get the different special circumstances agents and contact agencies and all these things in the confliction against each other. Some of them want to be turned into ship's minds and go off and join the ships. And others think that, that we should be, the humans should regain their place in the culture again. So we can have humans on both sides of the conflict, and maybe sort of drones as well, but not ships' minds. So we can actually have a confliction. And I was thinking, we can bring back different characters that we've met in the different culture books as well. So we can have Gerge, I think this is how you pronounce his name, from the Player of Games, and he can be on, say, the human equality side of things as well, and he can help plan the tactical maneuverings. And Dizzy Itzma and the drone, can't remember the name's drone, Scalit, or whatever his name is, from Use of Weapons, he can join in on the operation sides, and the guy from Accession, and these other people that we know, these other characters that we know, he can be brought back, and we can see them fighting out on the other side. And then I thought, on the other side, we could have maybe Vatuel, who we meet in this book, or maybe even Zakalwi from Use of Weapons, on the other side, like leading the confliction's enemies, and they're just mercenaries, and they're, because they're just the best, the best military guys that they have in the confliction. They've got form in other wars. They've been contacted by the culture to fight their wars for them in the past and things like that. And I think that would be actually a really interesting way of looking at it, that we can see different sides, different factions within the conflict going up against each other. Of course, on the outside of the confliction, you can still have the stuff with the ship's mines, and they can be taking pot shots at each other if they want to, and we can have contact with other non-culture civilizations. Maybe they're planning for the expulsion of humans from the culture, and they're all going to be dumped on the wider world, and not the wider world, the wider galaxy, and they have to deal with that. So we can have all the good stuff too, but I think one of the main conflicts has to be within the culture, decided by humans, with the culture itself at stake. Nothing, like, the culture can't be the same afterwards as it was before. It's been, you know, slowly changing, but very only slightly changing throughout the entire culture books. 8 books later, the culture is still there, and it's still, you know, scare quotes, perfect. It's still a utopia for the humans involved, and I either want them to regain their prominence alongside the ships, or if they're lost, all humans are expelled from the culture. And if any humans do stick with the culture ships, they're explicitly pets. They're explicitly, you know, subclass to the ships. If they want to be. So I think that's the kind of direction that I want to see the culture taken in. I want it to be tested in a way. And I think that would make a good book. Of course, I'm not saying that, you know, Ian M. Banks could or should write this, but I think it's a real sign of the strength of the creation that he's, or the world that he's created and his books, that it's not just me as a commenter on science fiction literature and a book reviewer that thinks that this needs to happen or this kind of thing needs to happen. I think that the culture has got to the point where it should be destroyed, or it should be tested, or it should be moved on from the culture. I think it's getting to the point that it's been explored so much that we need to break it. It needs to be broken. The culture needs to be broken. So that's the end of my review. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm going to give this book 4 stars. I say not a good place to pick up the culture. Read some other culture books first. Maybe just read them in order that they were written. Although there's one which is called, I think, Inversions. You don't need to read that one. Let me put it that way. That is set, like I say, that's set on the edge of the culture, and there is a culture agent in it who's going through, but it's not really a culture novel. Another good place to start is, of course, The State of the Art, which is a short story collection. So that's pretty cool. This is a very good book. It's certainly back on form for Ian M. Banks with the culture novels after a few lackluster attempts recently. The next book I'm going to review is P.D. James, a book by him called Children of Men. And I'm about, just under halfway through that as well. I'm enjoying it quite a lot. I'll get onto that review probably within the next week. And that's it. Email me, luke@juggler.net. If you've got any feedback and book suggestions or anything like that, you can also get in contact with me through goodreads.com and follow the books that I'm reading. Let me be your friend on goodreads.com so then I can do this. This is what I've forgotten I do here. Go into surface details. So the book has 4.05 stars by everyone. But then if I look here, I can go friends reviews, 24 reviews by my friends and listeners of this podcast. The average review is 4.31 average, which I think is probably one of the highest rated averages on of any book or of any SFBRP listener or friends of mine group average with any book that I've looked at so far. But I think it's probably because it's a new book. It only came out recently. So it's obviously going to be the fans of Ian M. Banks who get it and read it. And because it's an above average one, that it's going to be rated pretty highly. So Darren says here, really enjoyed this one. Seems like return to form for Ian M. Banks and the Culture Series. That's what I just said. I was tempted to give it 5 stars, but I've known better books, so I'll leave it at 4. Yes, there are other better culture books, I think. Play of Games, Use of Weapons, both very good. Tom Rose said, interesting story on slavery in the afterlife. Funny, sad. The only negative thing is that the ending is something that you have to be familiar with other Banks books to get completely. I'll read it. Is it? Or maybe the last line. Yeah, the last word. I sort of mildly spoiled that, but it's not a big point in this book. Dylan says, heard the audiobook and loved it. We'll be going back probably more than once to get the full juice. Not sure about some of the characters now, but that's probably because I've only been through it once. It's probably true. Some pretty good... I enjoy reading other people's... Paul has done a long review here. I enjoy reading other people's takes on books and seeing how you like it here on goodreads.com/Luke Burridge. Become my friend. And stuff like that. Otherwise, follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burge. And also check out my blog. I'm posting a bit more regularly to my blog with all my non-science fiction reviewing creative stuff goes onto my blog. And there's a new podcast that I'm putting out. Please check out lukeburge.com/creative for Luke's creative podcast. I do some pretty good discussions about creativity and lots of different subjects there. And finally, one thing that I want to mention here, please go to sfbrp.com and I think episodes-lists, or just, you know, you'll find the episode lists page page on sfbrp.com. I've listed every single book that I've reviewed so far by the, you know, the book, the order that I reviewed them, and by star rating and by author. So if you're going to like ask if I've done a review of a book or if I've read a book and reviewed it here on the podcast, please just check out that. And it's a good way to say, you know, find out my favorite books from the last 3.5 years that I've been podcasting. Yeah, it's almost exactly 3.5 years now, coming up to the end of June. So please check that out. It's a good resource. There's links to every single podcast, to, you know, to the Wikipedia page of every book that I've read, the blog post of every book that I've read, the Amazon.com page of every book that I've read, and yeah, and the Goodreads review or page of every single book that I've read here on the podcast and reading on the podcast. So that's a great resource for you. Anyway, I've gone on far too long now, so thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.